Session number 10699.
Brigadier Reimer Drones, Reel 17. I wonder now if you could take us through your opinion as to what the main elements of the Palestinian situation were, if necessary, going back before the time you arrived, of course.
This is a problem which goes very far back and is the old lifelong question of whether one or the other of Arabs and Jews have a real claim on Palestine, apart from the Jewish claim that Jehovah gave them the place which belonged to somebody else. And this kept happening in history. When you got the Hyksos rush down as far as Egypt and had that, and the Jews, when there was supposed to be led by Jehovah to go into Palestine, among others, and there was famine there. And at that time, the very brilliant Joseph, who was down there and saved the economic situation for the Egyptians, and that attracted his pals, most of the Jews, down into the land of Goshen, and they had a hell of a time until the indigenous Egyptians won the day, and the Pharaoh then wanted to treat the Jews a bit rough, to let his own people have their way, and that led to the Exodus eventually. And then the Jews decided, of course, that they were better in a country that Jehovah had given them. And that led, as you know, to 40 years in the wilderness, the toughing up, the brutal approach from the east again, including the murder of everybody in the Amorite country, and then in Jericho, and you remember that story entirely, and then continuing in killing men, women and children at Ai, and the Gideon stories, and so on, until they had grabbed what we knew as Israel, except the coastline for the Philistines and those people who were the maritime states. Well, it is obvious that there was an age-long problem about who owned Palestine, which has gone on and is now just as bad. It could never have been, perhaps we can take some credit, that during the period I was there, when we used no rough stuff at all and we didn't have military courts and all these brutal punishments, that there was some hope of getting the right answer. Ben-Gurion said to me at one stage, when we were waiting for the Anglo-American Commission to come out to decide the health of Palestine, he said, you know, I and this friend of mine, who was one of my pals, because I was a fourth officer of government, this was another fellow who was dealing with another side, and I saw them with their heads down talking at a party when we were going to welcome the Anglo-American Commission, and I slid over towards them, and I said, what are you naughty boys planning? And Ben-Gurion looked up with a grin, and he said, we've been trying to work out the Palestine problem by pure mathematics. And you see, this was his approach, and he was a wonderful fellow, a wonderful fellow, and he cooperated tremendously, and of course he was the first prime minister, and all was well, but he had this bitter foe of his in the Irgun.
I'll come back to that. How do you feel that the First World War had complicated the situation with the Balfour Declaration and such like as that? Do you feel
it complicated the situation very much, because you'll remember that at the same time as, or following what had been done in the Balfour Declaration, behind the scenes, Churchill and the other enthusiasts have always some this biblical story. There was a great enthusiasm without a great deal of thought about it. And consequently, that when the war came, and we were fighting the Turks as well, And it was very important that we should keep that part open, what they call the old land bridge, which allowed you to go to the east, and we still had India in these places. And this was terribly important to us. And I had gone out, finally after the war, to this job in Egypt, which was intelligence. And one of the officers in there, who was the scruffiest man in the army, temporary, was a brilliant fellow in every way. It was Lawrence, and quite apart from his role, which was a very minor one like mine, in the army out there, outside that, he had been digging and studying for his PhilDoc, which the subject was the Crusader Castles. He'd been digging with Professor Woolley and had become a brilliant scholar in Arabic, and he was a very strange man too. But when we were up against it as to how to deal with the Turk, who were running the Hejaz Railway, and you'll remember that the Hejaz was that strip of Arabia on the Red Sea which had Medina and Mecca and so on. And we sent Lawrence with bags of gold to the rather bad old man who was the head of the Hashemite family, old King Hussein, and we said, look, can you help us? And so he nominated his eldest son, Faisal, with his Bedouin and so on, to work under Lawrence. And you know the question, Lawrence of the desert and so on. But the important point was, when we finally, under Allenby, were making those last advances into Palestine, that a very important, not just a sort of a good fairy story, but very important was Lawrence and the Arabians on the right flank who were mucking up the Hejaz Railway and then advancing with us during the last part and were first into Damascus and into Aleppo afterwards before the army or cavalry or anybody else. And so that in this freeing of Arabia and of the Arab countries from the Turk, it was very important to realize that we owed the Arabs something for it. And Churchill, we must say, was spoiling it then by saying, oh yes, we didn't mean the freedom of the Arab countries west of Jordan, and that included Palestine, where all these pro-Zionists were plotting to give Israel an early thing. Now, here we're setting up a world question which we'll never finish, as you can see, what is happening now. Now, I've warned them that it would be like this, and it will never change.
You warned them in the 20s, you mean, 1921, when you were in Egypt, or do you mean when you were in
Well, it would be boasting to say, as I warned them then, that that was my opinion then, at any rate, and everybody knew that, because I had very great Jewish friends. You see, this is the people, they either took one bitter side of the problem or the other. Whereas I had a wonderful friend in Ben-Gurion. I have still friends in Teddy Kollek, who's been married to Jerusalem ever since. These were the good people under Ben-Gurion when they got there. You couldn't say, oh, we don't agree that you ought to be there, then you'd got to make the best of it. And if I may boast for a moment, I didn't deal with military courts at all. We didn't hang people the whole time I was out there.
I'm going to come to that when we talk about how you in,
yes.
So you
can see in the Palestine problem, it was quite obvious we made our own problems, because while we were appointing King Hussein's sons, like Faisal, to Syria and Iraq, and King Abdullah, another great friend of mine, a very clever man, to Transjordan, as we called it then. While we were doing it, there was a great deal of plotting on the other side to grab it all from the Arab, you see. And now I've always said, what's going to happen when the Arabs agree with each other and stop fighting each other like the Iraqis against the Persians and so on, that they'll turn on. And the trouble is, now, what have you got? You say, well, you haven't got the bomb. Israel have got the bomb. And now you've got the other way, in which you've got this latest thing you've seen in the papers now. And so how are you going to stop these people using it, you see, these wild men of both sides?
How about the Arab revolt of the 1930s? How do you feel that had affected the situation?
Well, this is a question. When the Arabs saw that we were allowing the Israelis to pour in, and they had this great thing behind them, we were being massacred by the Germans, you see. And they said, we must let them come into Palestine and ad lib, you see, instead of the League of Nations, as it was then, agreeing that they should go somewhere else. They were offered that their refugees should go to Uganda, for instance. They said, no, we don't want that, we want Jerusalem. So the pro-Zionists were winning, and the Arabs were getting wilder and wilder. And in the end, Begin, who fiddled himself in from Poland into whatchamacallit, instead of coming in as a supporter through the Free Polish, which was what he was supposed to be doing, lay low and then declared war on the Palestine police and the High Commissioner, on nobody else, not in the army or the civilians. So the whole thing was building up into an impossible position. I forget what your actual question was.
Yeah, it was more about the Arab revolt. But
the Arab revolt. Well, it got to the stage where the Arabs got so wild that, led by their head...
Would that be the Mufti of Jerusalem?
The Mufti of Jerusalem. They started by being very difficult, and it developed until 1936-39, it was called the Arab Revolt. I'm not sure you could, in which the police, of course, took a principal part in boiling it down, whereas the army under Monty out there started this awful business of military, went around hanging Arabs right, left and centre, of blowing down their houses instead of taking one or two as they're supposed to, and the thing became impossible. Until the Mufti turned against us entirely and fled to Hitler. And as you will know from my memoirs, that thanks to the Palestine police, it stopped the war being extended for a long time by the sending flying in high-grade German officers to command a new revolt of the Arabs. And what we should have done, what with that in the Jewish revolt, I don't know. But we were able to quash it straight away.
I'm going to come back to that. That was in 44, I think. So that's a review of a fair number of the aspects of the problem as you saw it. We won't cover a lot of the sort of, I'll just for the tape, a lot of the chronological material is covered in your memoirs, which is available in our Department of Documents. So we're not intending to go through that. We're going through the themes, as agreed. You went out in August 1943. What was the role of the Inspector General, and how did you work with the Army Commander and the High Commissioner?
Well, this was a very interesting situation because, you see, with the part we took or had to take, quite a big part in the Syrian campaign, let's call it, against the Vichy French and so on, we were involved to the extent that we were then dubbed a military force. And in any offences by our men, you started off while on active service, so on. So we put ourselves, I think rather stupidly, under the GOC for all military staff. And we were a military force on that side. And not further than that, we ourselves invited by plotting with the senior naval officer in the Levant area, through the Admiralty, the chaps who were in these covering the sea outside and inside, they were made RNVR and went from one thing to another until we were invited to join them in raids from Sidon and up in the north on the Greek islands. And they had to wear naval uniform, because otherwise they'd been shot, of course. So we were getting more involved from the military side, and we were very much. And it was very annoying to me, because we came to this famous date in February 1944, when Begin openly declared war on us and started killing my people. At the same time, which had been going on for a long time, the Ergun had been doing. And this complicated, it frightened the people at home more than it did us.
So you're saying that as Inspector General, you were actually under the control of the Army Command, the GOC, in the area?
No, only I used to go and see him on most days, but we were entirely, I was just coming to the point, that Mr. Churchill said, "Hello, this is very annoying. You must not have one single unit back from the fighting forces. You've got to get on with the show yourself. You inspected, I was the chief man out there." The GOC and C, he was a lieutenant general, he hadn't got any troops. He'd only got some of these headquarters of the ordnance and so on, and he wouldn't cooperate in helping me in guarding points and so on. It was an eternal war with me, trying with my dropping numbers, which meant that I had to fly to England and see everybody and so on.
What was his name, the general, when you first got out there? McConnell?
McConnell, yes.
What was he like?
General McConnell was a very nice man, but he was very a bit stuffy. That I didn't lie down and say, "You're my great boss," and so on. I was the chief man for law and order. That was my job, and so that I got on very well with him indeed. Normally,
was there any friction with him about you asserting your independence as IG?
One or two minor ones.
What sort of thing would cause friction?
That I said that I insisted on something happening. He wasn't in the position he felt to do it, because he was the Lord High Muckamuck, you see. And so it was a bit of war, because I knew what I wanted. Churchill at home in February 1944, while McConnell was still there, asked this question, you see, what does he want to do this? I insist that we must not have anybody back to help. He's got to do it himself. What does he want? He can't use his Palestinians largely, because they're mostly Arabs. So you can't use them against the Jews. It's the British section. What does he want? And as you know, we sat down, and the next day had forward what we did want, which was the police mobile force, like an armoured battalion.
I'll be coming back to that. So, although you had some moments of friction with McConnell, basically you worked together.
Oh, excellently, excellently. And still more so with the next GOC.
Gort. Sorry. Who was the next GOC? Yes, Gort was the next.
You put it out of my mind.
We'll come back to it anyway.
No, wait a minute. Who was it? What was his name? Oh, charming chap. He was a great friend of mine, but not on this military political side. And he let me down by going with the government on this blowing up the King David and so on.
I'm definitely going to come back to that. How about on the political side, your relationship with the commissioner, which the first one was it Harold McMichael?
The High Commissioner?
High Commissioner.
He was my boss. They all were my boss. And I got on splendidly, of course, particularly with MacMichael, who was the best boss I ever had.
What made him such a good boss, as far as you were concerned?
Well, of course, I was the fourth officer of government, and he was the big cheese.
But what was so good about him? Why was he a good boss?
Well, he was out of the Sudan, and the administrators who came from the Sudan, and there were a great many of them, were very, very fine. The ruling of Sudan was quite different anywhere else, because it wasn't passing top in an exam, it was whether you were a very good bloke. And it produced all sorts of good people, including MacMichael, who'd, during his army service in the First War, got a DSO, and was very a good man, and like I should have gone after it if I hadn't played the fool, went to the Sudan, where he became a senior governor of province and all the rest of it, and then came to us. He brought excellent people in on the civilian side, you see. I was on the civilian side. I was a fourth officer of
government.
Who
were the second and third officers? What were those positions?
Well, I think the Attorney General. I get a bit muddled. My great friend, of course, who's still alive, Sir William Fitzgerald, marvellous man. He was Attorney General when I went out there, and then became Chief Justice, who was in a way a separate top, and in another way, you might say, the second man, and. MacMichael, he was Attorney General then. When I had this difficult problem of the barber, who during a curfew, our people, when they challenged him coming out of his house, and he ran away and he was shot, the first thing I did was to go to the Attorney General. Well, he became the Chief Justice afterwards, Sir William Fitzgerald. And as you see, I just acted as an officer of government on that side, on the political side, you see, and I made it very clear on the law and order side where I was not prepared to go.
And where was that?
Or what I suggested should be done. Well, in the case of this thing, I said, well, I said to the Attorney General, I'm going to put out orders, and in standing orders too, that I will not tolerate that the quick finger on the gun will not be tolerated, and it never was, and it never happened afterwards, until this blasted army came back after the war.
And just to finish that, I might come back to this incident later, but did you prosecute the person responsible for the shooting of the barber?
Yes, it was rather natural in the circumstances that even the Jews were very pleased as I took quick action. And the government gave this chap, who was as guilty as hell, really, £300, which was quite a sum in those days to them, in compensation. And
the barber?
The barber, yes. And we were not attacked in any way by the Jewish press on this. And it went very well, because we had never had another thing. Although these frightful things were happened with the terrorists and with Baby and Boy, we never shot anybody. They were prepared to if they were being killed themselves, but even that, as you may have read, the story of the great riot and the self-sacrifice of a police sergeant who was badly wounded, and of the marvellous Jewish mayor from the desert, who both prepared to sacrifice themselves to save other people of a different variety. And all of which boils up to say that my fellows were marvellous, that there were marvellous Jews, and there were a hell of a lot of frightful ones, which they've still got. You've got the chief one in power out there.
Again, I'll be coming back. So you worked with the second officer, the Attorney General, to secure the rule of law. That was something that was important to you.
To some extent. And as I had very wonderful policemen under me, My regular RIC number two, also McConnell, who got up every morning of his life at 5 and got on his rowing machine and then did at least an hour on his books, his police books. He was wonderful in backing me.
What about this third officer that was senior to you in the sort of hierarchy? Do you remember?
I remember which it was. It was something which was not material in forms of police work.
Didn't affect your work.
It may have been actually. I don't know. What are the offices of government at home here? It was not important.
I can't think what it would be, actually, so we'll leave that. If it didn't affect your work. What was the composition of, when you went out there in August 1943, what was the composition of the Palestine police when you got there?
Palestine police, the British section, which was very important in this political state, you will agree, were some 5,000 men.
And what was the source of those?
And on the other hand, the Palestinian side, which you couldn't use in political matters, if you see, were some 9,000. And they were a marvellous lot. And we were a very cohesive lot from every point of view. And we didn't let politics come into it. Now, what may interest you from that point of view is that I used to say to my fellows, you will not be pro anything except for the mandate, which you're here for. You're the police of the mandate. And you will not be pro anything except for the mandatory government. You can be anti anything you like, as long as you keep your trap shut and don't let it affect your actions. I can't stop you being anti-Arab or anti-Jew in your mind, but you will not let it affect your actions. And they've been marvellous, and they never have, while the other people have been shooting us and killing us and taking all these wild actions.
So where had the 5,000 British come from? What was their origin? How had they been recruited?
Their origin were largely from the gendarmerie, which you will remember was largely formed, the British section was largely formed from the, what you call the black and tans, from the, and not only from the black and tans, but from the splendid policeman like my number two, who was one of the old regular RIC, and who I just, how he approached the police job, a really marvellous fellow. And so they were formed in that way, and they kept being reformed in a way in their actions and their work by people drafted like Dowbiggin in his famous Dowbiggin report. He thought that the CID ought to be not only strengthened but to change in their approach and so on until we built into this what I call the best police force in the world and what a lot of other people did.
So that was the composition of the 5,000 British. What the 9,000 Palestinian, what was the division between Jewish and Arab, would you say, between them?
No Jewish. No alteration. And they were all...
Jewish. There were no Jewish Palestinian police.
Oh, yes. Hell of a lot. And a lot of senior officers, too, in the CID. And they were remarkably faithful, too. I think one of the stories which illuminates that was when they grabbed one of my CID assistant superintendents, what we call ASPs, at the back of my headquarters in the street, and they ran him into the what corresponded to the Jewish Star of David building. I can't do it.